Before we dive into today's message, I was reading this week, there's a book called Liturgy of the Ordinary. It's by Tish Harrison Warren. It's a great book. If you're interested, I highly recommend that you should pick it up. It talks about just how we have liturgy in our everyday lives and how we can engage with God through the routine and the ordinary and the everyday. But in her chapter that was called Eating Leftovers, she writes this. She says, "My subculture of evangelicalism tends to focus on excitement, passion, and risk, the kind of worship that gives a rush. Eugene Peterson calls this quest for spiritual intensity a consumer-driven market for religious experience in our world. He says that there is little enthusiasm for the patient acquisition of virtue." Little enthusiasm for the patient acquisition of virtue. Little inclination to sign up for a long apprenticeship in what earlier generations of Christians called holiness. Religion in our time has been captured by a tourist mindset. We go to see a new personality, to hear a new truth, to get a new experience, or so somehow to expand our otherwise humdrum life. That's a powerful quote, isn't it? And of course, it's talking about virtue. And I thought that seems to be the case sometimes, is we have little enthusiasm for the patient acquisition of virtue, because that's what it takes, right? It takes time. We're talking about the slow work of God in our lives. And when we talk about wisdom and we talk about self-control, we're talking about these things as processes, as people who we become, not things that we do. We're not managing our way out of this. We will never be able to manage our way out of this. But when and if we find ourselves in the presence of God, in the presence of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, and we make that a part of our liturgy, a part of our rhythm, our routine, it won't happen overnight, but I can tell you, we begin to look like that which we spend the most time with. Okay? Let me say that again. We begin to look like that which we spend the most time with. Want to know why you're angry at certain things? I can guarantee you, you're probably filling yourself with angry people, angry voices. Are you compromising? You're hearing it somewhere. These are things. What are we filling ourselves with? What are we giving ourselves to? And so we're in the series. We're calling it Playing with Fire. We're looking at virtues. We're looking at the disordered side of virtues when we let them kind of run away and go into this uncontrolled fire, and how if we're not careful, the uncontrolled side can consume us. We looked at wisdom a couple of weeks ago. We talked about wisdom out of control can be just, especially in our day and age, this uncontrolled obsession, overwhelming information that we kind of continue to absorb as much as we can. And when we get to that place where all we want is more and more information, we find ourselves immobilized, because wisdom requires action. We don't just think it, we actually do it. And last week we talked about self-control and how out of control, self-control gives way to indulgence. We also talked about how God loves you to have a good time. God loves pleasure. He created us for pleasure within limits, because we know anytime we give ourselves to indulgence, it never works out well. I mean, nobody ever ate a complete bag of candy and said, "Wow, I now feel good." Right? And so, you know, what we discovered is that even though it's paradoxical, that self-control actually leads to greater freedom and allows us to realize our part in the larger story and encourages us to live beyond here and now, the eternal story that we are a part of. And today, we come to a virtue that I think is easy for us to see in exceptional circumstances, but it's often not thought about in the everyday choices that you make. So what I want to ask you is, what comes to mind when you hear the word courage? What comes to mind when you hear the word courage? Feedback. Come on, you got to talk to me. Okay, hold on. What was that? Strength. Strength? What?
Survivor.
You guys love Survivor, don't you? To go on the show Survivor would take courage, I think. So what else do you think of? To Kill a Mockingbird.
Trust.
David.
Brave.
Standing up to something or someone. Yeah. I mean, when I think of courage, I admit, I go to the extreme. I think about the firefighter running into the burning building, you know, putting their life at risk to go in and save somebody else. Maybe it's the soldier who falls on the live grenade because they're going to protect their fellow troops. The person who runs towards disaster, not away from it. You know, you've seen that image of a kid or even an animal that has fallen into the icy lake. You know, the ice wasn't thick enough and somebody jumped in to save them. I mean, that's where I go, because I think that's the easiest place for us to see it. The problem is that those examples that I have, if that's the criteria, then none of us usually are called upon to ever live a life or demonstrate courage. And so when we think about courage, we think, well, I'm not a firefighter, so I don't have to worry about it. Or I'm not in the military now, so I don't have to worry about it. And we think, oh, it doesn't matter. How could we even know if we could have courage if needed? That's the question. I mean, are we courageous people in how we live? And I think there's a challenge here, because I think we even live in a culture where we celebrate bravery, and we do, and we should, but we encourage fear. I mean, think about that. We do celebrate bravery, but we encourage fear. I went to some news sites this week. Take a look. Can you read them? I'll read some of them to you. Global financial panic. Recession odds jump. The Kremlin says the end of the world is upon us. Oil prices soar. And there's plenty more. FBI warns Iran aspired to attack California with drones. What are those for? Fear. They want you. We have an entire industry that is built on sensational fear-mongering to get a response out of you. And this isn't new, just so you know. I mean, I didn't even go back far, but going back 26 years, anybody remember the Y2K panic? The world was going to end. You still have water stockpiled. People were stockpiling water like crazy. The grid was going to crash. It was all over. And you know who made that worse? Christians. I feel like the Christian circles I ran in fear-mongered as much or more than the non-Christian circles for some reason. 2001, 9/11, we remember that. The world, you could probably ask everybody who was alive at that time, where were you? And you know exactly where you were when that happened, don't you? The world was going to end. People lined up at gas stations. Do you guys remember that? Like, gas stations were running out of fuel. Or, in maybe some more of your lifetimes, who remembers the panic of 2007, 2008, where the Great Recession, we called it, and everybody kept saying, oh, it's going to become a depression. And people, you know, I remember specifically at this time, prepping became kind of a bigger thing. Even a lot of celebrities, even Christian celebrities, started selling you food supplies because, you know, you got to be ready. And more importantly, you got to take care of yourself when this happens. That was interesting, right? In a culture that where we're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves, it really seemed to become very self-focused at that time. Or do we really have to go back and remember 6 years ago, the great toilet paper shortages of 2020? Forget COVID, forget the disease itself. Some of you people bought way too much toilet paper, leaving others of us without. Okay, everybody do this, take a deep breath. That's the world we live in, isn't it? A world that just continues to encourage you to be afraid, to live with such incredible fear. I will say, this is where discernment really should come in for us as Christians. We really need to make sure that we are not the ones perpetuating the fear, the panic, all these things. We need a spirit of discernment. Because I think if we're honest, when we get into that place of discernment, many of us would look and go, it is fascinating the people that are making the most money off of making me so fearful, or the people who are just trying to retain a level of power and control just by making me fearful. And we, as Christians, we have a hope. We have a foundation. We sang Cornerstone this morning. We talked about the same God. That's where we live. That's where we should exist. And we shouldn't be swept up into the fury of fear that exists around us. What's interesting is that as much as fear, I believe, is one of the disordered sides of courage, it's not the only one. Because fear can manifest itself in anxiety and worry. Can I get an amen? But I think there's another side of this as well. I'd call this bravado. Disordered courage can be bravado that manifests itself in aggression and domination and the need to prove something. What do you think? That's a little bit of courage out of control as well, isn't it? Or maybe not in its right place. And if we aren't careful, we can kind of fall into a couple different categories. We can become so overwhelmed and disgusted with what we see happening around us, or we can just become so overwhelmed we just check out, that we become discouraged. I mean, think about, we say probably discouraged sometimes, but do we really say it with the understanding of the word courage? What is discouraged? It literally means a loss of courage. And so maybe one of the ways we might most likely live a life without courage is that we become so discouraged that we find ourselves sitting on the sidelines, checked out, unengaged, not doing anything. And this can be tricky, because discouragement can sneak up on us. It can start slowly. It's reading a headline. It's looking at social media. It's hearing a friend or a neighbor say something. But slowly and steadily, if we're not careful, we can find ourselves more and more discouraged, more and more checked out, more and more unwilling to speak up, stand up, speak out. Or even just live the good, we'll just isolate ourselves, even when we're called to live as light. Because you know, as followers of Jesus, if we feel this, we feel this inside, we feel the discouragement, we feel the fear, we feel the anxiety, how do you think your coworkers and your neighbors and your family members feel? And what do they need? Not us driving into our lovely houses and shutting the garage door and keeping the curtains closed and just isolating ourselves. There's a reason Jesus said, "You are the light of the world." And what we're talking about is darkness. And the world needs us to be light. And when Jesus said, "You," good Southern Jesus as he was, he said, "Y'all." Y'all are the light of the world. That's what we're talking about here. Knowing that we have a propensity to worry and fear, don't we? Do you know that about yourself? Do you see that in yourself? Maybe not everybody, but some of us, we certainly have this, you know, leaning towards that anyway. One of the most repeated commands, one of the most repeated instructions that we find in the Bible is this: fear not. Be strong and courageous. Don't lose heart. Said different ways, but the same thing. Be strong and courageous. Don't fear. Don't lose heart. And probably one of the places we see this was as the children of Israel are going into the promised land. Their first challenge is the city of Jericho. It's walled. It's powerful. And they can't get anywhere else until they go through it. And Joshua, as the new leader since Moses has died, how do you think he's feeling? He's probably feeling the pressure. He's probably feeling a little bit of anxiety. He's probably wondering, am I the right man for the job? And in Joshua chapter 1, we know that he encounters an angelic being, a messenger from God, who says to him, "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." And that's just one example, because when you begin to read more and more of the Old Testament, you see this idea more and more. Psalm 31 says, "Be strong and take heart, all who hope in the Lord." Isaiah 41, I mean, these are the people that are facing or are in captivity. And the prophet says to them, "So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous hand." Jesus said these same things to his disciples. We talked last year about the Before I Go series. Jesus is giving his disciples the final instructions. And in John 14, he says to them this, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. Do not give to you as the world gives, but do not let your hearts be troubled. Do not be afraid." Or just a little bit later in John 16, where he says, "I've told you these things so that in me you have peace. In this world, you might have trouble." No, in this world, you will have trouble, but take heart. There it is again. Take heart. I've overcome the world. Even the early apostles kept this message going, and boy, didn't they need to, because they're facing persecution. They're being dragged out of their houses. They're being killed for their faith. And in 1 Corinthians, Paul writes this, "Be on your guard, stand firm in the faith, be courageous, be strong." Or again, when he's talking to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 1, he writes this, he says, "For the Spirit God gives us does not make us timid." Oh, we've read this one the past couple of weeks. "For God has not given us a spirit of fear," not timidity, "but gives us power, love, and self-discipline." You get the point, right? I mean, we could go on. There's many more verses we could bring into this. But what we know is it's easy to read this. It's easy to read this and go, okay, I'm going to be courageous. Until we face that situation that calls for courage and we have to find ourselves struggling, will we really have courage? Courage is difficult to know if we really have until we face the test, isn't it? I love a good Bible story. I love especially the ones that were made by vegetables and VeggieTales. In the book of Daniel, we're introduced to four young men who have been carried off from their homeland into captivity, and they're put into the service of King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, they didn't ask for this. They didn't desire it. It was thrust upon them, but they did well in the service of the king. They were sharp. They were efficient. They were good workers, and they were devoted to Yahweh. They were devoted to the one true God. One of these young men was Daniel. He interpreted a dream for the king, and he's elevated. And in his elevation, he helped his three friends be promoted to administrators over the province of Babylon. Now, we know these guys as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or as VeggieTales calls them, Rack, Shack, and Benny. There you go. Story takes place in Daniel chapter 3. One day, the king, what is it with people in power? They're never content with the power that they have. They always want just a little bit more. They always want, and I would love to say that has stopped over time. It really hasn't. We still see it today. But the king decides, "I want an image of gold. I'm going to build this statue." Now, we don't know what the image was. We don't know if it was him or a false god or whatever. But we're told, now think about this, it's about 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. Think about, ChatGPT told me, this is about proportionate to the Washington Monument. Not the same height, but proportionally. You're talking, you know, thinner base, kind of going up like that. And here's what happens. The king then tells everybody, "You're going to hear a band. And when the band plays, you are all to fall down and worship this image of gold. And if you don't, you know what I've got waiting for you? A blazing, burning furnace." Times were good back then, weren't they? Whenever you want to feel like you're persecuted as a Christian here in our culture, I want you to read Daniel chapter 3 for me, please, just to get perspective. So what happens? The instruments played. As the instruments are playing, everyone did what was commanded. Well, almost everyone. And of course, it wouldn't be a good story if there weren't some snitches involved. Some astrologers went to the king and they're like, "Oh, king, you remember what you said. You said everybody had to bow down. And if they didn't, you were going to punish them. You remember that, king?" And he's like, "Yeah, I remember that." And then they go, "Well, there's some people who didn't do what you said." They said to him, "But there were some Jews whom you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Now, what does that sound like? Jealous. I mean, these guys, we don't know that for sure, but why are they mentioning their positions? Because they're elevated, they've caught the attention of the king, they've been blessed in the roles that they've been given. These guys, we're going to take them down a notch. And so, for whatever reason, they called them out. And the king was furious with rage, we are told. He brings Rakshak and Benny forward. And he says, "You know what, guys? I'm going to give you another chance. Maybe you just didn't hear it. Maybe, you know, I'm just going to, whatever it is." And he reminds them. He says, "But if you don't worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Man, you feel the tension? You feel the excitement building in this story? What's interesting is these guys don't need the music to play. They don't need to hear the band again. They immediately respond to the king and they tell him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Wow. You want to stop right here just for a moment and kind of ask yourself the question, what would I have done? It's not a fair question. We're not there. We're not in that moment. You know, it's hard to do that. But we all want to assume, I would have, I would have stood up. We're going to, in just a moment, look at maybe why they were able to demonstrate such courage. When they said this to the king, as you can imagine, as with most people in authority, they do not like to be told no. They do not like to have their authority challenged. And so the king said, "That's fine. I told you what would happen. Into the furnace you go." And he wasn't content just to throw them into a furnace. He wanted it cranked up. And he did. He ordered that furnace to be 7 times hotter than normal, where the story tells us that the soldiers that threw them into the furnace died from the heat. Isn't that crazy? Just a reminder that when people in power do stupid things, it often has repercussions for those not in power. So they bind up these young men. They throw them into the furnace. The furnace, as I said, killed the soldiers that were ordered to throw them in. And as they're thrown in, something amazing happens. The king, I don't know how, if he's looking down, we don't know exactly how this thing is set up, but he's able to see into this furnace. And as he looks inside, instead of just seeing these 3 individuals, he sees 4. And Daniel 3 records this. It says, "And the 4th looks like a son of the gods." Now, pastors often like to say, "Oh, it was Jesus." We don't know that. Could have been an angelic messenger. Could have been the presence of God. We don't know. We don't want to make it more than what the passage tells us it is. But based on what's happening here, we know God was protecting them. Because as he sees these 4 individuals in the fire, he calls the 3 men out and he sees that they are completely unharmed. They don't even have the smell of fire on them. And he makes a decree at that point against saying anything. If you say anything against their God, you'll be cut into pieces. Isn't it amazing how the pendulum swings? Just calm down, King Nebuchadnezzar. Huh. This man obviously has issues. And then what does he do? He promotes him again. And as he's doing this, the king makes this statement. He says, "They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God." Don't you love a good story? This is one of the great ones. As I said, if you need to be refreshed on it, Rack, Shack, and Benny from VeggieTales, great songs in it, just so you know, great music. What do we learn about courage from this? Because I think we would all agree this is a story of incredible courage. What do we learn about this? I'll tell you, these aren't earth-shattering points, but probably points we need to hear and understand. Why were they so willing to die? Because this is probably the first and most important point. Courage comes from conviction. Courage comes from conviction. And conviction is often in short supply today. How many times have we seen people, maybe people we've looked up to, trade their convictions for a seat at the table? For a taste of power and honor, for a lot of different things. That is a lack of courage. Courage requires conviction. What do you believe? When all is on the line, when your power and control is at stake, when your comfort and security are on the line, what do you really believe? I mean, that's the question, isn't it? Because conviction says these are the things that I am unwilling to compromise on. These are the things that I am unwilling to give up for clicks and followers and votes. These are what's most important. You see, it takes zero courage to fall into groupthink. It takes zero courage to go along with the crowd. And we can try to justify the outcome as much as we want, but the means are just as important as the ends. Jesus never calls us to compromise our convictions and our character to follow him. Period. And without conviction, we open ourselves up to what James describes in the New Testament as unstable, blown and tossed by the wind. You see, these three friends knew exactly what they stood for. They knew if they capitulated, they could easily go along with the crowd. They could go unnoticed, or even better, if they went along with it, they might even get a promotion. They might even get a career advancement. But they understood something critical. They could not be faithful to God and bow the knee to the statue at any cost. They would not betray their God. If we look at our lives and we see capitulation, if we see wishy-washiness, if we see a desire to chase certain undesirable things that within us we know we shouldn't chase, we maybe need to ask ourselves, is that lack of courage because we have not settled our convictions? What is it that we are unwilling to compromise on? Now, I think that requires discernment. Not everything requires going to the fire for, but we have to admit there are some things. And I think Jesus helps us to understand what those things are. That's the first thing we see. But there's something else in the story. What else we see in this story is that courage doesn't mean strength and power. I mean, we said that, didn't we, when we asked what is courage? That kind of came out. It means strength. It means power. It doesn't. What power did these guys have? None. They were at the mercy of, or the lack thereof, of the king. And we can see he had no mercy. These guys had no power. How much courage does it really take when you carry the biggest stick? I mean, can we ask that question? Is it really courageous if my stick's bigger than yours and I'm more powerful than you? No, not really. Sometimes the most courageous thing we can do is not respond with power or violence. I mean, Jesus even said it, the meek shall inherit the earth. What is meekness? It is power and authority without having to prove it. It is power and authority under control. I read something this week that said this, the meek are not the people who lack power, they are the people who refuse to misuse power. Couldn't we use a little more meekness around us today? Another thing I think we see from this story about courage is this. Courage is unsure of the outcome. We often think with courage, well, we know how this will end. These guys didn't. I mean, did you catch what they said? Our God is able, but even if he doesn't. I mean, there's an uncertainty there within them. I mean, look at the passage. If we are thrown in the furnace, the God we serve is able, but even if he does not, we're still not going to serve you. We're still not going to bow down to this idol. They did not know what was to come, but the outcome didn't matter. The outcome was insignificant to their courage. Courage is risky. Courage can be costly. They knew what was right, and they were willing to do it even at the cost of their lives. And as I said, this is, I think, where we can get tripped up a little bit, because as much as we sometimes feel persecuted, and yeah, there's different levels of persecution, and I get that, but none of us live with the fear of our lives at stake for our faith. The problem is if we live only with the idea that courage has to be life-sacrificing, we can miss the daily sacrifices that maybe we're called to make, to courageously make, even and especially if it costs us nothing. Are we still willing to make those courageous choices every day? It's another aspect of courage here I want you to see. I think it's important. Courage comes and it's built in community. Courage builds in community. That's why we have the word encouragement. And in the New Testament, we hear encourage, build one another up. It mattered, I think, that there were three of them in this story. They needed each other. And how much easier is it to stand when you have somebody else standing with you? In the end, they all three got thrown in. But it was meaningful to have somebody with them. And I think one final thing and probably equally important thing about this story is that courage comes, and Tim, you said this, courage comes from trusting. And where does trusting come from? Sometimes trusting comes in the waiting. When you look at Psalm 27, it says this, wait patiently for the Lord. Be brave and courageous. Yes, wait patiently for the Lord. What does the prophet Isaiah tell us? But those who hope, see that word hope? That's the same Hebrew word as wait. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Waiting on God sometimes is the difficult part. We want it now, but it's in his presence that we find strength. It's in his presence that we find peace. It's in his presence that we find hope. All things that you cannot manufacture on your own, even if you try really, really hard. It just won't happen. It's what Jesus, I believe, told his disciples before his ascension. What'd he tell them? He said, I want you to go back to the city and I want you to wait. For what? Power. The Holy Spirit was coming. But they needed to wait in order to experience it. And boy, they needed it, because we know that many, if not all of them, gave their lives courageously for the cause and the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let's wrap this up. When we talk about courage, we have to remember it's not the absence of fear. Okay? It's not the absence of fear. Courage is faithfully continuing even in the face of fear. Courage is doing what is right when you are encouraged to do wrong or to look the other way. Courage is doing what is hard when you want to take the easy way out. Courage is telling the truth when you are tempted to lie. And we won't have the courage in the big things if we don't have courage in the daily little things. And there's no greater example of courage than we see in Jesus. Do we agree with that? I was reading this morning Mark chapter 15. This is our study that we've been going through. I got to tell you, this week for us has been walking, being a friend with Jesus through his last week. It has been hard to experience all that Jesus experienced. As he's in the garden, as he's waiting for his arrest, as he knows all he has to do is snap a finger, speak the word, and angels will come. They will rescue him. He will be taken out. There's nothing. And yet, he surrenders. They bind him up. They walk him out of the garden. They walk him into this unjust trial. They beat him, they mock him, they spit on him, they humiliate him. Remember the word meekness? All authority, all power rest in this man. And he sits there. Was Jesus courageous? Absolutely. He's a model for us that sometimes courage looks like surrender. And hear what I'm saying there. We all know that sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes if you're in an abusive relationship or an abusive situation, sometimes courage is getting the heck out. But sometimes courage looks like surrender. So are you fearful? Are you anxious? Are you overwhelmed by worry? Maybe what we need to do is invite God into those spaces to ask for the courage to move forward and then wait. Don't try to make something happen, just wait. Because as I've already said, like our other virtues, this isn't something you can manufacture. This is something you receive after spending time with the Trinity, the Father, Son, and Spirit. So worship team, come back. We're singing probably the perfect song to close today. It's called Take Courage. And here's what I'm going to ask you to do. You can close your eyes or not. I don't care. But we're talking about receiving courage, not ginning up courage. And if you're comfortable, just put your hands out in front of you. You can put them on your lap. And just think about your life. Think about where you are. Think about what you're experiencing. Is there an area of your life that you fear fearful? Is there an area of your life that seems to just come with a little bit of overwhelming anxiety or fear, something that you know you cannot control? And just right now in this moment, would you say, Father, Son, and Spirit, meet me in my fear. Meet me in my anxiety. Meet me in my worry. Meet me in the falseness of my bravado that makes me want to convince everyone of how strong I am when inside I know it's just a front.